Episode 5. Don't take our word for it. Welcome to our podcast, Stand Up for Reefs. My name is Kate Holden, and our guest today is John Bothwell, Manager of Legislation Implementation and Coordination for the Cayman Islands Department of Environment. So far, throughout our podcast series, we have discussed many of the issues facing coral reefs today, how scientists are trying to combat the threats, and how engaged stakeholders such as photographers and teachers are all working to help to make a difference. Today, we're going to speak to John, who has been working with the Cayman Islands Department of Environment for many decades, and his job is summed up superbly as turning research into conservation. And this is what the Stand Up for Reefs podcast is really all about. So we are looking forward to talking to John. The Cayman Islands is more famous for its tax neutral status than it is for its commitment to the environment. And hopefully today we can shine a brighter light on the incredible work that goes on here, because the environment is something Cayman should be famous for. The Cayman Islands is part of the UK Overseas Territories, and Cayman's abundant reef ecosystems mean it's a significant contributor to biodiversity in the region and to the UK Overseas Territories, or UCOTS. It is estimated that 97% of the UK's biodiversity comes from the UCOTS, and the position of the Cayman Islands, which is 270 miles south of Jamaica, means it's interconnected with the wider Caribbean Sea and the Atlantic, feeding into the global nature of ocean health. In April 1986, the Cayman Islands took region-leading decisive action to protect the coral reef ecosystem by establishing their first Marine Protected Areas, or MPAs. In episode 2, we talked about the goal to establish 30% of protected ocean areas across the world and the fact that less than 7.68% of the ocean are already under this protection. Over 25 years ago, Cayman made a hugely progressive leap, despite some resistance to change locally, and implemented an MPA system that is world-leading. The MPAs have recently been enlarged to 46% of the national waters and coastline. The DOE have also spearheaded key species programs, such as the conch and lobster no-take programs, that work to ensure they can be fished by locals, but the populations are given space to recover, ensuring a sustainable future, as well as the Nassau Group of Spawning Aggregation work in Little Cayman, and countless studies on sharks, turtles, parrotfish. John has also been involved in crafting the Biodiversity Action Plans, which provides a holistic policy overview of how to protect the coral reef ecosystem across the spectrum of ecological service systems. What the DOE accomplishing in the Cayman Islands is now being replicated in many places around the world, and it is worth finding out what local initiatives are taking place near you and supporting them where you can, especially for key species. I've said this before, but when you are travelling, please find out which food is locally sustainable and ecologically sensitive. The Nassau Grouper project in Cayman highlights an excellent example of how consumer decisions have a huge impact. As grouper is a firm favourite on many menus around the world, it is a delicious fish, but it is also a key species. Groupers spawn in the same place each year, all arriving at the same spot in a frenzy of fish biology, and fishermen all over the world have cottoned onto this and lie in wait to bring in a huge catch. This has decimated grouper stocks, but one of the few remaining aggregation sites is in Little Cayman, thanks to the DOE and their research partners Reefs and Scripps and the Guy Harvey Ocean Foundation. So it has been protected and is still viable, ensuring the Nassau grouper populations can rebound for the future. Everything that John will be talking about today can be 100% relevant to anyone listening. Whilst he is based in Cayman, local conservation is taking place across the globe, and we can all get involved in making good decisions to help protect important species. Let's meet John and talk about how he is standing up for reefs. Welcome, John. Hello, John.
Hello, Kate.
You have been working at the forefront of coral reef protection for many years now, contributing to what I believe is one of the best conservation programs from a government. So firstly, what do you love about the ocean and coral reefs?
I love the beauty of them. and being down there. So I grew up fishing here in Cayman, and that was what introduced me, and then snorkeling, and then getting into scuba diving, and just the absolute beauty of being down there underwater in the giant aquarium that we call our reefs. And that is still what attracts me to it. Some of it is that hereditary attachment to it. This is what, like I said, it's what I grew up doing, as my forefathers did. But there's also that emotional connection, which I think is very hard to make people appreciate sometimes, that we can talk about why we save these things and we talk about as a fisheries resource or anything like that. But really, that is all dollars and cents. I love the reef. I'm saving the reef if I can be that grand, because it almost deserves to exist itself. It is just that beautiful and great to see.
And is that what made you decide to join the DOE, that connection?
Absolutely. That's one of the things. It was that growing up fishing, I like sciences, so I gravitated towards that, biology and things like that. And then what are you going to do? Well, marine biology would be great, because on the good days, they pay me to go diving. On the really great days, I got to go fishing to get samples, you know, so it was a great job. And it is a job, let's be honest. And that's another part of it. And a small tropical island, there's only so many careers around. So some of the other things you might have, you know, look at as a young person, they weren't there. They probably all them and still aren't here. But science, STEM fields are growing exponentially around the world. Even here in the Cayman Islands, we keep needing more technical staff we need more technical staff, but the country needs more technical people to do all these kind of things. And where it has grown a fair bit is the sort of non-technical side of things, where we need science communicators, for example, things like that, doing what you're doing now, so that they help us explain to a wider audience, but also a local audience, why these things matter, why we are doing what we're doing, and how that will hopefully benefit everybody.
Well, I think the DOE are doing a pretty good job of that. And actually, I remember when I first arrived in Cayman, which was in 1994, with some friends of mine, and the first thing they did was their dad took me out conking. Because that's what you did. Come on, girl, let's go. And we were out, and you know, and so there's, I think the way of life is really important. Mm-hmm. And yes, the science can help inform it, but actually, you know, the sea is a commons, and for island people in particular, it's having access to all that wonderful fish life for leisure, recreation, and sustenance is super important. So,
yes.
In terms of the MPA policy, which I do want to talk to you about, because I don't think many people realise just how incredibly, you know, progressive Cayman's MPAs were over 25 years ago. Like, that was a big, big deal. And if every country around the world implemented a similar system, we would hit our global protection targets, which I think, you know, the fact that Cayman is over the global protection target. So what was it like in those first years developing the MPAs?
So I wasn't actually here then. I was still in middle school at the time, or sort of pre-high school. So I'm one of the people, I essentially grown up with those marine park rules. I remember when they were coming in, they were a big deal. And talking to the people who were involved in doing it at the time, it was very hard to get them through. But even then, we had that advantage that you talked about. People recognize this is our culture we're trying to save. At the same time, we're constraining what we're doing. So how a lot of this stuff gets started is the resource users coming and saying, we're seeing a problem. So back in the 80s, what prompted the marine parks or marine protected areas at that time was particularly the resource users coming and saying, it's getting harder to get conch and lobster than it used to be. You know, as you said, you come here for it, you get conch. Conch in the Caribbean was our cod for people in the UK, I imagine. You know, it was what everybody ate and you could get. And from prehistoric times, people have been eating conch. And when you start seeing they're not as easy to get as they used to be, that's a yellow flag to people. And so the pre-Department of Environment government agency at the time, you know, did some looking into it and said, listen, the way to go that's it's just getting started in other places in the world is these marine protected areas. Think Australia had done it. And, you know, that was the kind of where they were looking and saying, what is the emerging trend in fisheries management at the time? Because if you think about a small island, you know, we're well resourced for, you know, the size we are, but still we're not going to be able, particularly in the 80s, but even now, going to be able to go out and check everybody doing everything to, you know, count how many conchs you've taken and quotas and that sort of thing. But if we said that area over there is set aside, no taking of conch and lobster, you can take them over there, that's relatively easy to police and also easy to explain to people. So they went around to the communities saying, almost essentially, hi, we're from the government, we're here to help. So you can imagine how well that goes over. But how, you know, this is the tool that we suggest you use. Where do we put these protected areas? You're saying there's a problem, how do we fix it? And that's how we got the marine parks. They did them for Grand Cayman first. So if anyone's listening to this podcast that doesn't know Cayman, we have three islands, the big one of Grand Cayman and two smaller sister islands, Little Cayman and Cayman Brac. And when they got they said, let's start with Grand. And when that was going, I think, getting close to being finished, the people on the other islands said, well, actually, don't forget about us. And so they went over and did the same consultation over there and put the parks in place. And those early parks, protected areas, were particularly conch and lobster. And so we had this thing called replenishment zone, which was no taking of conch and lobster, no spear guns or fish traps, but you could still catch fish by hook and line in there. We also had a few what we called marine parks, zones within the marine park system, which were no-take zones. And that was particularly done as our diving industry was just getting started. And again, people were recognizing this is worth a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It would really be better to leave the big groupers, the big parrotfish, et cetera, on these reefs so we can charge scuba divers money rather than eating them ourselves. And so we put in these no-take areas almost to begin separating the divers from the fishermen, as it were. A lot of this is about managing resource users. The fishermen, which is a brilliant thing for a marine protected area, because I protect them in one place and they spill over to the next spot where I can keep fishing them. Mm. So it's about managing the user base. And that's how we got started. There's a lot of resistance that, you know, people still tell stories about. But then over the decades, and that first set of parks were in place essentially unchanged for 30 years before the enhanced version of Snow coming to force, people recognized these are working. We're still seeing decent numbers of fish, lobster, conch. Also recognizing we have many times more, a larger human population now than we did in 1986 when this all kicked off. So, you know, and we know a lot more about our marine resources. It's time to enhance them, leading to the public meetings about enhancing the marine parks, the marine protected areas. And there again, we saw a lot of strong resistance. And a lot, it is very understandable. We're going to people and saying, there's a problem. Here's a tool we can use. But to address the problem. But this tool impacts you directly. And when we can sit down and we can talk about things like human population and just how much we're all taking, and maybe there's a different way we could manage that take so that it doesn't mean you can't go fishing in your backyard anymore. And we can talk a lot about climate change and development and global warming and the seas warming and ocean acidification and sargassum algae blooms making things harder to fish for different things now than it was 20, 30 years ago. And those are almost all problems that are outside of a resource manager's ability to affect. What we can do is work with people to set aside protected areas, and we know they work. But it does mean the fishers, and particularly the law-abiding ones, the mm-hmm. ones who want to be part of the solution, having to almost give up the most.
Yeah.
Because we've still got poachers. You mentioned conchs. We've just finished our annual conch survey that we do in selected sites around the islands. And one of those areas has been a completely no-take of conch zone for the last 35 years now. And every year or two, our conservation enforcement officers will come and give me the joke, don't bother surveying there or throw out your survey numbers from this year, because we just caught a poacher with 100 plus conchs out of there.
Oh, wow.
The poachers and our enforcement officers know that these protections are working.
Yes.
The legal fishers don't get to go in there and see it.
No.
So it we understand it's very hard, but by people recognizing they want a healthy marine environment, that's how we got the parks. And this enhancement process we did this time of, making our protected areas better, it started by just, the 25th anniversary of our marine protected areas, asking people, how happy are you with the marine environment right now? Looking forward 25 years, what do you want to see? And that got the conversation started, people saying, we want a healthy marine environment. We want to be able to go and do X, Y, Z and take our kids there. We want nice beaches. We want pretty reefs. We want fish in the reefs. We want to be able to keep taking conchs. Oh, yeah. This might mean a harder conversation, next month, the next time the DOE comes back.
Yeah.
But if that desire by the public wasn't there, we'd be off doing something else, saving, frigate birds or something.
Yeah. So, if there's any one listening that's thinking, there might be a local conservation issue that they've got. So from your perspective, for someone who has, helps to put them in place and deal with the general public, and some very genuine concerns, as you said, the legal fishers have to often give up the most. What would you say to someone to be coming into that process from the other side of the coin? What would your advice be?
Be patient. Marine protected areas. I said we started the 25th anniversary of the marine protected areas. We probably got the enhanced parks in place in something like the 35th anniversary.
Wow.
It was that long.
Yeah.
We applied for overseas funding to support the project. It was a beautiful plan we had. We'd come, we'd do the public consultations, we'd work out with the public what we wanted, we'd do our research, because we do at the Department of Environment try to underpin with science our recommendations as much as we can.
Yeah.
And so we had some, again, working with Australian technology, this time, on how do you plan a marine protected area. You plug in all the biological data you have, and it spits out this beautiful mosaic of where it'd be great to protect. And then you kind of, okay, let's apply some common sense to it, which is how the process works. And then you start talking to the public. And so we were going to do that, and then we would roll out the new park, the new marine protected areas, new marine parks. And we knew that would mean more signs and buoys and everything, and marking it. And so we had that built into the funding program, and there was a program officer for it. I think that program officer, she's now onto her second post-DOE job.
Yeah.
We're just now getting in the signs and markers to put up where all the enhanced zones have been changed.
Mm.
It is a long, long process.
I remember I've been to a few of those consultations, and it was pretty tough. You can see some people have some really genuine concerns, and there's very strong feeling, as you said, the connection to the ocean and the reason that people are connecting to the ocean, whichever it may be, whether it's fishing or whether it's through leisure, does evoke some very strong response. And I was pretty impressed, because I saw quite a few consultations where there was it was a tough audience. But I think you're right. At the end of the day, you have to look at what the end goal is. And I think that the Department of Environment has worked incredibly hard to get everybody on the same page on the end goal, and then work through it. But I didn't realize that it had taken really 10 years to get for that extension.
And that, I mean, that's it. It's about keeping your eye on your, what is your end goal?
Yeah.
Not being too tied to your vision of the end goal from 10 years before. It's what it's about. And so working with people, you have to work with people and keeping, recognizing it's going to be a compromise.
Yeah.
And working towards that. I mean, we knew we had kind of reached that point where on the third or fourth consultation, we had people trying to change, the members of the public trying to change things other members of the public had asked for the last time around. And that's when you know you've about hit that middle point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're never going to make everybody happy. All the fish aren't happy either with what we have.
No.
But it's the best we could come up with, and it's, we think it's really good.
Well, it's certainly one of the best. I mean, I don't know many countries that have a better, certainly percentage coverage. So, I mean, that's a pretty good job.
We were so very proud of the Caymanian public and the government for what they said they would do.
Yeah,
we went in there with what we thought was a stretch goal, and people looked at it and said, "Yes, you're absolutely right. If we want these benefits, we know we got it. This, we know we got to take a big step," and that's what they did. And so that's another thing for people is, again, patients not giving up, knowing that you're working towards a good goal and sticking with it. Not accepting half measures can sometimes be the best thing you can do, because it's very tempting. Someone will offer you kind of a quick win, but if it doesn't actually achieve what you want, the risk you then run is, when you come back and say, "Okay, Mr. Minister, leader of government, thank you for giving us the first half of our ask, but we still need the second," and they're going to look at you, "What are you talking about? I've now moved on to some other problem." The society is dealing with something else, because every country has roads to build and everything else we need to do to keep growing, hospitals, etc. We thought we fixed your problem.
Mm.
So it's about keeping that big picture in mind and making sure to get, you know, what you're going for. The other thing is, like I said, do recognize particularly people are giving something up. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes people who you might think are natural allies, once they have to give something up, it becomes a different story. And we did see, and so this is something that people, you have these different stakeholders in the public, we like to call, we like to call them, to give everybody a neutral name. And the stakeholders will sometimes see themselves as being on different sides of the fence. But often there's a lot that unites them, particularly when I walk up and say, "Hi, I'm from the government, I'm here to help." Suddenly both sides get worried. And we've seen this a few times, that suddenly people who were pushing for something, once it's going to constrain how they've been operating, they've literally jumped the fence.
Yeah.
And they're suddenly like, "Whoa, wait a second, not here. I meant over there."
But I think what's interesting is, because the science and everything, the DOE has some amazing scientific programs that go back many years. And actually, I think, again, in terms of your species management and therefore the empirical base that you have. So people can have opinions, but you guys have the facts in many ways, and that probably helps with some delineations.
It does. And it also helps us to, so we could walk out and talk about marine protected areas, and the second sentence was usually, "But we know this isn't just it." You know, we have certain species, conchs, for example, where we need catch limits and closed seasons, because just a protected area is not going to be enough.
No.
And so all those people talking about, "Well, what about closed seasons in this?" They can, hopefully it helps them, like you said, respect us a bit better, that we're not just there with whatever latest idea came through with no science background on it. You know, we have the numbers sort of same as them, as, you know, whatever they're seeing out there as resource users, we're seeing as researchers, and we can put the numbers to what they're seeing. And so we've done that at the Department of Environment. They come to us and say, "We're not seeing as many conchs, we're not seeing as many Nassau groupers, what's happening?" And we can go out there and then say, "Well, here's what's happening." You're right, the numbers are down. You're also right, the sizes that you're finding are getting less. That is classic overfishing scenario. So what you thought was may happening is what's happening. And this hopeful scenario you might have that maybe the fish have just swum off to somewhere else. Well, okay, we'll go and check around. And no, sorry, look, they haven't. Mm. We ate them all.
Yeah.
We're still in a good position in the Cayman Islands, conch, Nassau, grouper. We have populations of them that we can manage and save. But yes, it is about recognizing that it's happening in advance. When the resource users come to us and say, we're seeing a problem, we need to be there ready for it. Coral reefs are a slightly interesting one where it's almost more the scientists pushing there is a problem than the resource users. Because from up top, if you will, the reef is still there. It's still providing structure for the fish to hide in. This idea that it is the forest of the sea. Well, yes, and that forest structure is still there. The physical breakdown hasn't occurred yet just because the species are dying. But from our perspective, those coral species are the canaries in the coal mine. Their climate change is just kicking them out of the coal mine, killing them on top of the diseases that went around the Caribbean previously. On top of the new diseases that are now coming here in the Caribbean, at least, that are, it feels like, taking out whatever's left of the corals. And so what we're having to look at and say to the public is, yes, things look good now, but as we did with the marine parks, let's look ahead 25 years.
I think the reefs are really difficult, aren't they, from that perspective? Because I am not a marine biologist, but I've done a lot of diving, and you don't always, you know, we still don't know what we're looking at. And that's, so with fish, you can, you know, you're used to, and if you're conching or you're lobstering, you're used to a certain pattern. If that pattern changes, you know, you recognize it. If you're a fisherman and your pattern changes, you recognize it. But with the reefs, it's so complex that the patterns can be changing unless it bleaches. And then, so I always found really interesting, the dive community were brilliant at knowing. They'd be like, everything is bleaching, often before, you know, some of our team used to know about it, and because they do the same dive sites fairly routinely. But unless it's something, you know, that is as obvious as it going stark white, all the things that can be happening in the background, even disease, which, you know, unless it's a really prevalent one, can quietly be tinkering away in the background. And it takes quite a lot for those of us that aren't looking with a trained eye to really notice. So I think the coral reefs are really difficult from that respect. And I think the other thing is, you know, who doesn't love a grouper or a turtle on a dive? Who doesn't love a conch? Like, you know, or if you're snorkeling, whatever, they're beautiful, they're very engaging. And actually, Caribbean coral isn't quite as sexy in many ways. The Pacific coral is a bit more colourful, but it doesn't have the same wow factor on an individual basis, I don't think, to everybody on a bigger scale.
Yes, and particularly because we're all looking at degraded reefs now. And we have the shifting baselines that kick in, and it looks kind of nice. It looks like it looked a couple of years ago. You know, I'll take it.
Yeah.
And so it does get hard. And again, that's where they say the science comes in. The Department of Environment can look back, show back over decades of taking photos of the reef for our surveys. And this is something that we started, again, many years ago. We're one of the first in the Caribbean to do it. We didn't just do a transect and say, okay, there was this coral, this coral, this coral. We took picture. We did the transect with a camera and literally took the pictures. So we can go back to the same spot year after year after year and basically compare the pictures and say, okay, so here's a coral that it bleached in the 80s and it recovered and everybody went, yay! And then a couple of years later, disease moved into it and it bleached a second time and it kind of recovered then. And now and then it died off between the bleaching and the disease. Oh, look, they work together. Oh, there. And now after another few years, that entire coral head has just kind of withered and broken off and gone.
Yeah.
And so what still looks like a reef, we can now go back and show actually it's less reef than it was.
Yeah.
We can only do that because we've been doing the science, which then allows us to underpin conversations like this.
It's pretty tricky. But I didn't realize that you did the photography records as well. That's pretty cool. And again, very forward thinking. In the 80s, I'd imagine the underwater camera setup was quite fun for that.
It was bulky. Again, I'm talking about Cayman being in a good position. You know, we could afford to get one of these cameras and build a little tripod underwater that we could hit the same spot of reef and get a set size picture so we could, you know, do the counts. And what it was, that was back when, and this was, I was just starting out as a researcher, so this was a little bit before my time. Scientists, the best they could do, so you could kind of go over it and count the number of corals, but obviously coral structure is a three-dimensional structure. Mm-hmm. And so what they were trying was things like laying sheen, a light sheen over the coral, and you would count how the links went up and down, because they, they were a known length, to figure out how regossed the reef was and things like that.
Yeah.
Because at the same time that people knew this was important, the reef seemed very tough, you know, and that there was a lot of them, and were you really hurting them? Not really. It was still there, you know, six months later after you'd done this. Whereas in Cayman, we said, maybe there's a better way. I mean, we found this for ourselves, and while other, you know, research partners were saying, listen, the best we can do is still, you know, going with a tape transect and stuff and just counting on a clipboard, we could move to that. And now, of course, the science is moving to this thing called photogrammetry, basically 3D pictures of a coral head.
Yeah.
We've been able to do that. And it involves a computer in the 90s, and we all went to little tablets now. We've gone back to a tower computer because it needs that much processing power to run these 3D models.
But it's very cool, though.
It is. And again, going back to the same thing that scientists was trying to do with the chain links by saying, really, what is the shape of this live coral? Mm-hmm. So the science is hard, but we're in a lucky position here in Cayman Islands to be able to do it, that we've got the resources.
And do you feel now, though, so I interestingly saw, I think it was an IUCN top 10 species recovery, of which Cayman was in there. I can't remember, forgive me, which number it was, but it was like to do with the turtle populations and the grouper populations were rebounding. Obviously, the conch and the lobster being, you know, maintained as part of the programming. Do you think that the people of Cayman are now starting to feel the benefit of, so all those years of, you know, uphill effort by the DOE, and I've been to some of those meetings and it was definitely effort. I think now that there's a pride in what has been accomplished, because Cayman is quite far ahead of many other countries. And so they're facing the same issues that Cayman was facing 25 years ago, 35 years ago.
Yes. So, benefit is a tricky one. Mm-hmm. People are feeling the benefits, and even if that benefit is just pride.
Yeah.
So let's stick with the turtles. They're slightly less emotive, hopefully. Oh, so
we love the turtles.
People are quite proud that we have a nesting turtle population again. Mm-hmm. Let's keep living in the 80s. Back then, the science was that the Cayman Islands nesting turtle population had been extirpated. Mm-hmm. The scientists weren't seeing it. The Department of Environment started the first beach nesting surveys to say, went back and said, let's double check this. Mm-hmm. And we found, okay, there's still a couple of turtles nesting. So technically not extinct on our nesting beaches, but so close. It doesn't matter. And those numbers have climbed. We've got dozens of volunteers now helping us walk the beaches, looking for the nests and stuff, and really cataloging the numbers. And so we know the numbers have been going up, not just because we've got more people looking, but because we've got turtles per sort of square mile of beach, which is brilliant. And people are proud of that. I mean, if everybody's watching this, you can see the turtle is on the top of our coat of arms kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's what we identify with as a people. And if you're a tourist location who has turtles nesting near your beach, this is something that, you know, your tourists, your returning condo-owning residents like to see and know about. They take great pride that you have, hi, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. Please watch that on YouTube. don't come and try and watch it live because you're going to disturb that turtle nest and the excavation and the turtles running. I mean, we get people down there with flashlights and like, that's the wrong thing. They see us with using a red light to take some pictures and
be very careful.
And so they come the next night and try to do it. And again, we've got turtles going the wrong direction. Or we've got the nesting turtles coming up and
running into people on the beach.
To see that and interact with them. And all of a sudden, then that nest doesn't occur.
Yeah.
We now have new problems with turtles and people. And so benefit is tricky. We're now coming along to telling those people who are very proud about they've got turtles nesting on the beach, okay, but you got to turn off all of your lights.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, every couple of years, I'm pulling a giant nesting female turtle out of your pool because she got lost. Or there's 50 hatchling turtles dead in your parking lot.
Yeah, because they're going the wrong ways. And so they follow the moonlight often, don't they? Yeah, and they're
oriented the moonlight reflecting off the water. If there's a bright light on shore, that's where they're going to go.
Yeah.
And, oh, look, I'm here from the government. I'm here to help. You turn off your lights.
Yeah, please and thank you.
Suddenly, they're not benefiting from this turtle anymore.
No.
So we've gone from, we're moving now from a save the species type conservation to people and animal interaction conservation, or some other species like our groupers, which is one of the ones that made the IUCN list for the recovery, which has just been amazing. But it's an amazing recovery on one or two spawning aggregations out of about six that we knew about. I tell people, to put it in perspective, there's one spawning aggregation that's been protected for as long as I've been in the Department of Environment, and as long as I've been there, we've never found groupers, Nassau groupers, going there to spawn because it was fished out before we
could even get it. Before you could protect it.
But some of the fishermen know there's more Nassau groupers out there.
Mm-hmm.
Could we go back and start fishing them? Because that's what we're saving them for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And bless them, the fishermen would be very happy with some kind of very limited seasonal. Give us a quota of three, or maybe a quota of 100 divided up between whoever's going out there, you know, do it as a raffle for who gets to go get their free fish because it's their traditional activity.
Yeah.
This is what they grew up learning this from their fathers, who got it from their fathers, etc.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who do not fish. These were not fishers who missed that seasonality of that food source.
Yeah.
Turkey at Thanksgiving, they had grouper at Christmas kind of thing, after Christmas. So, but I'm here as a scientist saying, yes, it's recovering, but with a capital B, capital U, capital T, it is not recovered.
Yes.
We're not there yet. Yes, we could sustain 100 fish off of the healthy aggregation a year. Let's be honest, we probably could. But how do we police that?
Yeah.
How do we assign that fairly? How do we keep the recovery going if people are fishing it? When we know that as there's more groupers get caught during the rest of the year when it's not a closed season. Again, we've done the tag and recapture studies and got a lot of recaptures from actually fishermen saying, hey, I caught one of your groupers.
Mm.
Completely legally, that's great. We want to know. But we know that they're catching a good percentage of the groupers that are out there, even when not fishing the aggregation. So to your question, there is a lot of pride in these recoveries. Mm-hmm. People are benefiting from them, but it is not necessarily the direct resource users benefiting from them.
Yes.
So again, we're coming to certain groups of people and saying, for the good of the nation, we need you to turn off your lights.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. So benefit is tricky. We are very proud of our recoveries as a country. But we do have those who are benefiting without cost and those who are benefiting with most cost and making the two sides happy.
I think the whole fishing discussion, so interestingly, not to take us off on a tangent because I think we could spend all day talking about it, but I think the Seaspiracy, which I don't know if you've seen, but it has definitely ruffled a lot of feathers around the world in terms of, we didn't realise and we should just all stop eating fish. And that's a really, first world problem. because there are communities that rely on fish and communities where it is their first source of protein, and traditions where, you know, they're capturing a minimal amount often, but, you know, mm-hmm. with more people and more pressure, that then turns into, you know, overfishing. Yes. So it is incredibly tricky. And I think from a commons perspective, you know, that, so one of the things that makes me quite cross is seeing grouper on a menu. You know, I think this is something a lot of people feel quite disconnected. So outside of Cayman, you know, you're in the US, you're in the UK, or all over Europe, you know, I'm not sure I can make much of a difference. Yes, you can. You know, when you go to places, or even when you're living in your own place, find out, you know, what is managed sustainably. So I had the privilege a couple of weeks ago of going out to a restaurant, which is the first time, because obviously we've had quite a severe lockdown. And I had some delicious fresh oysters that were locally harvested. I know they're part of a sustainability program. They were fresh. They were fantastic. You know, I don't eat them very often. So for me, it ticked all the boxes. And, you know, that's actually probably better than me eating a steak that has been imported from South America and has, you know, destroyed a whole load of rainforest or whatever to be used. So that's not quite accurate, but there we go.
Yeah, but was that the best use for those oysters? Because obviously you paid a fair bit in the restaurant for them.
I did.
But should the traditional resource user have been able to go out and harvest them for their family dinner?
Yeah.
And just use them themselves, and, you know, not some. So that's the issue we have here in the Cayman Islands is, as you said, a few people taking a few fish, lobster, whatever, no problems. We know we cannot produce enough for all of our tourists and all of our residents, all of our people on our tourists when, you know, post-COVID they all return, all want to go to the restaurant and have a grouper sandwich, a lobster bisque, whatever it is, comforters. We don't produce that stuff locally. So this then becomes a very fraught question, at least in the Cayman Islands, of, you know, should natives have first preference to certain of these harvests, and how would you regulate that?
Yeah,
a lot of, you know, emotionally, a lot of people will say yes, absolutely, but as the manager, I can say, well, okay, how do you want to manage that? Are you going to be carrying your passport with you when you go fishing?
Yeah.
It gets really fraught very quickly, which brought us back to marine protected areas being the best, the simplest, the most effective approach. It means we still have conch, et cetera, in the open seasons, in the open areas that people can harvest.
So which is the most effective conservation program? Because I know that you have headed up, you know, personally quite a few. So which is the one that you would be the, you know, the John Bothwell moment of pride?
Top three would be our marine protected areas, and then our overarching National Conservation Act, or allows us to create protected areas on sea and in the land that we use to identify protected species and put in place management plans for them. Again, those are the two that I worked on that are really going to have a huge benefit for the country.
Yeah.
The other big one that we did, and we can credit the aides for this one as well, was our public mooring system. Mm-hmm. We have several hundred moorings around the Cayman Islands. They're for the public to use. They're put in by the government. Some are put in place particularly for, you know, visiting yachts, so they don't have to anchor and smash our coral. Some are put in place, you know, other public areas, you know, where you can fish or dive. A lot of them are put in at scuba diving spots primarily, because, you know, the scuba guys are going there every day having to anchor between a fisherman, whether you're a fisherman, scuba captain, a yacht captain, all the best will in the world, trying to put your anchor down in sand. People make mistakes, and bam, that's it. So that is one of the biggest things that we did. I've always tell people that was putting in these public moorings. They probably saved more coral in the Cayman Islands than almost any other one thing that we did, and had a direct save impact. And that wasn't necessarily the scientists doing that. That was our operations crew. The guys who keep a boat running and put up signs and put in their moorings.
So super interestingly, I had no idea. So I came and started to work as a dive instructor. I've been diving in Cayman for many years and I moved over eventually in 2007. I had no idea that the rest of the world didn't do moorings. You know, it was one of those things that's like, it makes perfect sense. It's so easy operationally.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. And again, here in the Cayman Islands, we borrowed that from Florida, give them the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary and the rest of them full credit. They came up with this mooring system and we borrowed it and we did some refinement. They did some refinement. And as you said, you know, the whole time I've been diving here in the Cayman Islands, we've had these public moorings. I went to university in Florida. We dove the Keys on the moorings. The idea that other places don't do this, yeah, because it is such an incredibly effective way to protect our reefs.
So I think also Cayman did the 3-4-5. So there's 3-4-5? 3-5-6. 365. It's the number of days in the year. There we go.
That's 360. This was the marine resources people working with our tourism department, because in the Cayman Islands, everybody's second or third job is we're tourism ambassadors.
Yeah.
You could dive a different dive site every day of the year in the Cayman Islands if you wanted and never have to throw over an anchor.
Yeah.
And that was very deliberate on the part of everybody involved.
And do you know what was lovely? The excitement of when a new site comes up and you could tell that it hadn't been dived and that there was, you know, it was beautiful and the fish were just ever present. And I think that's such an amazing system from a tourism perspective, and let alone an ecological one, which again, you know, Cayman has been forefront on.
It is, but it does then raise a very interesting management challenge. As you said, you can tell an undived dive site.
Mm-hmm.
And so having these public moorings, or the public antibody to use, you can fish off them in the fishing areas and dive them. But do we move them or do we keep them in one place?
Mm.
And so this is a constant, well, not a constant, but it comes up every so often, it's back and forth. Let's pull out a couple of dive sites to rest the site and put new ones somewhere else so we can dive a new reef.
Yeah.
Think about how fast coral grows. We'd have to rest the site for, 100 years?
Mm.
We have a lot of diving in the Cayman Islands, a lot of good diving. We probably don't have enough to kind of rotate 365 sites over the course of centuries. So again, it is about managing divers as a user group. And this then suddenly gets very challenging for how do we do that? And we have some sites that, you know, we've had people say, let's pull out this dive site. And point out, yeah, but there's one on either side of it. And they're so close that, we've done the studies.
Mm-hmm.
We know a diver is going to go up to about 200 yards, 200 meters from a dive site, you know, back and forth. You know, when those three dive sites are sort of 600 meters apart in total, taking the one in the middle out doesn't
help. Yeah.
Yeah.
I live in the middle of the New Forest and you are supposed to stick to the trails. We have a few and most of them are actually horse trails. So, you know, a human doesn't make as much of an impact as a several ton horse. But it is tempting to come off them. But you're right. So the trail is well worn. You've done the damage almost to that bit of the environment and the wildlife has reacted around it. So the birds don't nest around it because they know that that's where the horse is going to be and the humans. If you then start putting different trails in to take the pressure off that one, the ecosystem around it then has to adapt all over again. So yeah, it's kind of...
And that is a huge sustainable development issue for the world, for the Cayman Islands going forwards. Actually, in the UK, the idea of redeveloping brownfields, because that is the most environmentally appropriate thing to do.
Yeah.
In the Cayman Islands, we don't have brownfields yet because we haven't been developing that long. but yes, the idea that redevelop rather than clear a new area, or where's your energy going to come from? We're in the Caribbean, solar would be amazing. But please don't chop down a new forest to put in a utility scale solar plant.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not, losing the trees for solar panels may not be the best benefit. It might cost us a bit more, but distributed solar atop rooftops might be a better way to go environmentally.
Yeah.
But balancing environment, cost, et cetera, et cetera. All this stuff gets very, very tricky, but important to do and important to have these conversations with the public. So thank you for doing these kind of these podcasts.
So if you had a message for anybody that's listening about, you know, what difference could they make? So if you, anybody all over the world, so particularly poignant to coral reefs and the ocean, what would you ask them to do?
Organize. Actually, before you organize, look at things critically and then get organized. What each one of us individually does is important. Turning off the lights, to take that old classic example we try to teach, you know, teach the kids, that does matter. You know, me once switching off the light, maybe no big deal. Suppose it's 5 billion people switch off a light. That saves some CO2 emissions. So things add up. We're a small island in the Caribbean. We have to keep reminding ourselves what we do is a contributing factor. It adds up. And when you organize it, when 5 billion of us switch off a light switch in an organized
makes
fashion,
a huge difference.
That matters. But it comes first from looking. And so one of the things that we've done on some Earth Days, for example, is we've gone out, we've worked with the dive industry and done reef, you know, just divers doing reef surveys. How much coral did you see? Was it a lot, you know, how sick, how many instances of disease? How often did you accidentally touch the reef when you were diving?
Yeah.
And people start looking at, you know, what was a beautiful reef and they just went to look at the nice fishes. But then we've asked them to count how many of the fish were over 8 inches, which in the Cayman Islands is sort of the basic size limit that, you know, you can't catch a fish less than 8 inches. Mm-hmm. How many of them were a Nassau grouper or a turtle that did you see? And people then suddenly started looking at the reefs a little bit differently. Mm. Or whether it's just that you look at where is my energy coming from a little bit differently, yeah. Whatever it is. And it is that looking at it, in the case of these reef surveys, looking at it like a reef biologist, really seeing it for what it is and for the problems it's having. And then people suddenly started noticing, well, actually, there might be a lot of algae on this reef. It still looks pretty, but all the space is taken up by algae. And that then leads to this conversation, well, actually, reefs can undergo a phase shift from coral-dominated to algae-dominated and what that means. And what are the contributing factors to that? Well, the lack of big pirate fish that you didn't see on the reef. Mm-hmm. They're not there to eat the algae. You know, these are complicated problems. Here in the Caribbean, and back in the 80s, there was a die-off of long-spined sea urchins, Diadema antelarum, which were apparently just everywhere on the shallow reefs, from the shoreline on down. And so much they were an annoyance to people because people kept getting
standing on them.
And it was, you know, these were things no one liked. And then they got a disease came through and they died off. And that's when people really appreciated, actually, they were scraping a lot of algae off the coral, off the reef, leaving open exposed rock for young corals to settle out on.
Yeah.
They were doing an incredible job. And at the same time, then we were fishing down our big pirate fish, which is the other significant grazer on Caribbean reefs. Here in the Cayman Islands, we were lucky. At the same time this was happening, we were putting in the marine parks and things like that. So we still have and some pirate fish, you know, helping to keep the algae in check because, you know, it's been 30-40 years now, the long-spined sea urchins have not recovered.
Nice.
Significant numbers. And all of these parts play into whether or not we have a pretty reef or not.
Yep.
And it's when people look at it critically and start seeing the trees for the forest.
Yeah. And if not, find out. And I think that the most, you know, we live in a world where information is at our fingertips. And, you know, I think I went to the doctors not that long ago and he Googled something. So, you know, it's perfectly acceptable. If you don't know, go home and Google it. You know, find out. So I think it's really natural, whether you're in your garden or wherever you are, to be like, oh, this thing here bothers me, like the sea urchins. It's uncomfortable when I stand on it. But it is there for a reason. Everything is there for a reason. The slugs in your garden are there for a reason, whilst they might be a pest and eat your lettuces. You know, there are many things. And I think just things like bees, everyone is now waking up. So when it becomes a crisis, then the world is like, oh, okay. Because the knowledge is out there. It's nobody, you know, a lot of this stuff has come from not knowing, where now we know. So, you know, everybody, we know. So please, you know, let's start getting organized, as John is an advocate for. So before we go, we are going to have a quick Q&A. And this is from Alex, who is age 7. So it's not highbrow. And he says, John, what is your favorite ocean creature?
I'm going to go with octopus, Alex, just because they're amazing. It was just whatever last cool creature I saw most recently, but octopi, I was reminded recently how incredibly smart they are. Their ability to find little baby conchs when I can't find them on the survey because they're eating them every night. They're just amazing creatures. So I'm gonna go with the octopus.
That's a very good answer. They are incredible. What has been your best ever dive?
Oh, okay. It's going to be one of my first wall dives. So here in the Cayman Islands, the reef kind of trends off to, let's call it 60-ish feet, and then it drops to a million.
Yeah.
We have a dive called Big Tunnels, which is you come in at, let's say, the top of the reef at 60 feet. So you're looking around, it's still a pretty reef, and you go down at this, you know, into a cave, just a very short cave, and you pop out into the blue. And so you're coming through a dark tunnel with the bright blue in front of you, and you just swoosh out into that. And that's you just flying out into nothing, and it is amazing. If anybody's been to Bloody Bay Wall in Little Cayman, it's the same sort of thing where you're just out there on the side of the reef, free, you're like a fish.
Do you know what I love? And actually, I think one of the things that's worth mentioning too is Cayman has the most amazing water visibility, which makes that dive. So you feel tiny, 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 and you're a part of this massive, massive ecosystem and world. And I think it helps put life into perspective. For me, that was definitely the, you know, you might be worried about something or thinking that something is a problem, and you go and do a dive like that and go, oh, I'm really this tiny speck in this big, you know, ocean. And it's an amazing feeling because it is stunning. And Cayman's waters, which, you know, again, that we could do a whole podcast on that, can we, John? But because of a lot of the management structures that are in place, and also the topography and the depth grades around it, which make it so, it's absolutely breathtaking. So if you could change one thing to help protect Cori, so you have a magic wand, John, you are, you know, omnipotent Mr. Coral Reef Savior, what would you change?
I'm going to cheat and go with two on this one, Alex. Sorry. First one is climate change. Wave the wand, climate change is fit. It's not changing. The corals will survive somewhere, some of them, but what it's going to cost to the people adapting to the loss of our coral reefs, et cetera, I don't want to lose them, so I would wave the magic wand and it would fix climate change. The other one is this new disease we have here in the Caribbean, in Cayman Islands, SCTLD, stony coral tissue loss disease. So as I said, there's three Cayman Islands. We have it here now in Grand Cayman, not the other two islands yet. And although we don't have a magic wand, we do have a tool, which is for divers, divers to disinfect the dive gear. Between dives, but definitely after a dive trip. So I recently went to the sister islands to do some work. I re-disinfected my dive gear, my gear a second time to make sure I wasn't taking anything over with me. Just in case. And this is something that everybody can do, whether you're a diver, a fisher, a boater. We're asking boaters to disinfect their bilges to make sure that we're not moving this disease around, either around Grand Cayman, but most particularly over from Grand Cayman to the Sister Islands.
So interestingly, and I think, John, this is something, obviously, you know, the world has gone through a pandemic, so we're probably all a little bit better schooled on how to be more hygienic than we might have been 2 years ago. There are lots of plus points that can come out of this kind of... So SCTLD is bacterial?
So... No, you said Alex's questions were easy, but
sorry. Well, you brought up the toughie.
I stopped doing, you know, Q&As with high school kids because they ask too much. The question is too probing, really.
Too simple.
So we don't know what is causing the stony coral tissue loss disease. Mm-hmm. Think of coral disease science as being almost back to the dark ages of human biology. There's only probably one or two, at least in the Caribbean, coral diseases that we actually know the causative agent. The rest of it, we're still trying to figure out. And the coral tissue loss disease is no different. So here in the Cayman Islands, we're partnering with regional researchers, trying to get them samples from corals that are healthy, corals that look healthy, but we think are probably getting sick now, and corals that are sick to dying. Because we're to try and help figure out what is doing it and how can we treat it. So we don't know. It's probably bacterial, but exactly which bacteria it is, or maybe it's a couple of them working together, we don't know. What we do know about, I should say, what we do know is, again, we have a problem. We work with the best science we have to try and do what we can. And disinfecting our gear is one big thing that people can do to make sure we're not part of the problem. Because, again, while we can't prove it is hitchhiking on dive gear or in boat bilges, some of the spread we've seen here locally in Grand Cayman, but again, we got this from other researchers overseas and that we partnered with where they saw it first and how it kind of hopped around the reef. It looks possible.
It's in the water column. So anybody that gets in the water, can be responsible.
Yes. Whether you're a snorkeler or a diver, if you're a snorkeler, please disinfect your stuff. We have things in a DWE website. Like I said, it's on the internet. Google Stony Coral Tissue Loss Disease and how you can disinfect your gear, your boat bilges, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like turning off a light switch. It's going to make a little difference, and it will be a really big help.
Okay, that's really cool.
Do it right.
So who inspires you to keep doing what you're doing?
I'm going to say my younger self, the me who grew up, going fishing with my dad, going snorkeling with my friends, and remembering what Cayman's environment was like when that kid was out there doing that stuff and exploring, and finding octopus on a shoreline, with my friends, kind of thing, and trying to have that for the Cayman Islands of the future.
That's amazing.
That's it. Yeah.
And if you could work anywhere else in the world, I mean, obviously I'm not suggesting that you want to, but if it was offered, where would you go?
Can I move to the sister islands?
Oh, of course you can. That's the perfect answer.
So if I could work anywhere else in the world, Hawaii.
Oh.
Or possibly someplace like the Arctic, that'd be something completely different and amazing. I'm just not sure I could do more than like one season where it's that cold, though.
Given that you've had a tropical lifestyle, it might be a bit of a shock to the system to be there for too long.
That's what I would go for my constitution.
Yeah. John, that is the end of our. Thank you so much for your time today. And I want to say a massive, massive thank you to the Department of Environment in the Cayman Islands. And we will put a link onto this website so people can find out more about them, because they have done an amazing job over many, many years. And for being someone who's watched from the outside, the amount of attention to detail, the professionalism, and the motivation to get certainly the MPAs through has not been easy, and it's really amazing to see the journey and the effort that has gone into it. So thank you to the DOE. Is there anything else you'd like to say as a wrap up?
No, thank you for having me on. Happy to do this, and thank you for doing this. The more people are thinking about Cayman's marine environment, but about the environment in general and conservation, the better. So thank you.
Excellent.